It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. More people are using apps like Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb to find work, but the work isn't consistent, according to a new study examining the sharing economy. We'll take a look at why that's happening and explore how this type of work is reshaping the way we look at employment. Do you rely on platforms like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, or some other app to supplement your pay, or is it your full-time work? Just not enough to pay the bills? Do you do it for fun? Maybe the pay is an added bonus. Maybe you rely on these apps for all of your pay. Why is full-time work so hard to come by? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to be talking about this, and we'll take your calls as soon as we have some lined up. So 800-642-1234. Tell us how you're doing in the sharing economy. Arun Sundarrajan is a professor and a Robert L. and Dale Atkins Rosen Faculty Fellow at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. Arun, welcome to The Morning Show.
John, delighted to be on.
You've written a lot about the sharing economy. First, tell us exactly what that term means. When you say sharing economy, what do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about a family of changes that are reorganizing how we sort of deliver goods and services in the economy. Instead of big companies hiring people full-time, offering them sort of a stable job and benefits and, you know, the companies delivering the goods and services to people, we instead are moving into an economy where platforms are aggregating demand from consumers and then connecting to sort of these distributed and independent workers and small businesses who provide similar goods and services. So instead of going and watching television provided by a big TV channel and a big studio, you go to YouTube, which is a big company, but aggregating the content from millions of tiny content providers. Instead of going to a hotel, you go to an Airbnb with millions of hosts. Instead of going to a transportation company, you go to Uber or Lyft with its millions of drivers.
So which digital platform seems to be the most popular among people seeking work today?
Well, it depends on what kind of work you're seeking. I think if you're someone who wants to earn money driving a car, Uber is certainly the most popular, although Lyft is catching up. If you want to make extra money renting out a spare bedroom or renting out your home when you're not there, Airbnb is far and away the most popular platform for that. If you're looking to make extra money sort of with, you know, extend your small business into the digital realm or your freelance work into the digital realm, let's say you're doing yard work or you're doing home cleaning, TaskRabbit is popular, Thumbtack is popular, Handy is popular. And so it really depends. That there seem to be sort of marketplaces and platforms for specific professions and for specific ways of making money that have taken off. If you're a computer programmer, you go to Upwork.
Well, it seems like new apps are popping up all the time for this the gig economy, as it were. From what you've written, we can expect to see this trend to continue. For today's youth, you write that the future of work may be more uncertain than ever. Are we headed to a point where we just won't have traditional employment anymore?
I don't think we're going to actually completely get rid of the full-time job, but we'll probably get to a point where it's the exception rather than the norm. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, full-time work was not that common. It was more common to own your own farm or to sort of work as a freelance worker. And then over the second half of the 20th century, we got used to this idea that work is the same as someone paying you a stable income and, you know, you providing your labor and talent to them. I just think we're swinging back to what we've historically seen, which is, you know, people working for themselves will become much more common. This is a good thing in many ways because it allows you to pursue your dreams. It allows you flexibility. It gives you a lot more leeway to do what you want to do rather than what you have to do. The downside at this point is that we've constructed a lot of the good things of the economy, a lot of the stability, a lot of the benefits, a lot of the, like, you know, the paid vacations, the predictability of income, all of that social safety net, at least in the United States, has been constructed assuming that people are going to hold a full-time job and that there is this entity called the employer who can participate. And so for today's freelance workers, since we're in transition, they don't have as robust a social safety net, and so things can seem a little fragile, they can seem a little more uncertain than they should be.
I would imagine that it also makes it more difficult to collect taxes. I mean, a lot of this economy, gig economy, is cash, isn't it?
Well, some of it is, but one of the benefits of the large digital platforms is that they're actually formalizing a lot of what used to be informal as they grow it. And so, you know, if people used to rent other people's apartments through Craigslist, say, or, like, you know, you went to Europe for the summer, you would rent someone's apartment there, and a lot of this was off the books. Now that all that business flows through platforms like Airbnb and VRBO, who are sort of sending 1099s to the federal government, it seems like while the informal, like, you know, while the gig sort of portion of the economy is growing, a lot of what used to be informal and sort of under the table is now being formalized. So I think this is actually good news for the IRS.
Okay, well, I guess the other thing, I've seen some other articles that are kind of headed in this direction, and that is we're in sort of a race to the bottom in terms of the internet making a lot of these individual piecework kinds of things global, and you have people who will work for a dollar in some country that a dollar means more than it does in the United States. Is that a potential real problem here, that people will just make a lot less money for the work that they would like to do?
Well, I think that it depends, again, on what profession you're talking about. In the long run, I'm not worried about wages sort of, like, you know, being driven down in this race to the bottom, because wages in other countries will catch up, or at least sort of, like, you know, start to rise the way they have in India for software engineering or in China for manufacturing. But I think there will be a transition period where if you do the kind of work where you don't actually have to be physically co-located with the person who you're doing the work for, you will see some downward pressure on your wages, or your wages could go down because of the gig economy. On the other hand, if you actually have to be physically present, the gig economy platforms may actually raise your wages. So, for example, if you make your money painting fences, if you make your money as an electrician, if you make your money as a plumber, if you make your money as an event planner, all of these are professions where you actually have to be in the same geographic area as your client. And so international labor competition isn't really going to affect you. Okay. On the other hand, if you're a web designer, if you're a computer programmer, if you sort of do graphic art, these are things where someone in another country can do the same work that you're doing, even if their clients are thousands of miles away. So my research shows that there will be some downward pressure on wages in the short run.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. We're talking about the gig economy with Arun Sundararajan, professor at the New York University Stern School of Business. It's the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A lot of people are starting to use apps like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb to find employment. But the work isn't consistent, according to a new study examining the sharing economy. Arun Sundararajan is a professor of business at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. In a study J.P. Morgan Chase recently conducted, it showed that more people were using apps to find work, and we've talked about why people might gravitate toward that. But there have been other things. There have been a lot of discussion about this study since it came out. One of the things is that one of the reasons people gravitate toward these is that the barriers to entry are so low that it makes sense for workers to just dabble in this kind of work occasionally. Does that mean that this is an opportunity for people to try something they might not have thought about doing before, but, well, I can do this?
Well, I think that the fraction of Americans who are earning part of their income through freelance work, even though they have a full-time job, has grown steadily in the last 15 or 20 years. I think one in five Americans who has a full-time job actually supplements it with some sort of consulting or freelance work or gig work on the side. And so these platforms definitely present an opportunity to, you know, sort of dip your toes in the water and see if this kind of work is good for you, and also build some skills running your own business, being a micro entrepreneur. Another interesting thing that I think the study highlights is that the volume of work done on these platforms seems to be growing, but the number of hours per week that the average worker is working on, say, a platform like Uber seems to have dropped quite significantly. And so while more and more Americans are, you know, dabbling in the gig economy, it seems that increasingly, at least in the short run, they're not doing it as their primary income source, but they're using it as their secondary income source.
And what about the hourly wages that people make doing things like driving for Uber or Lyft? How does that compare to what they might make if they had what we might call a regular job?
Well, you know, if you compare, it depends on, I guess, which city you're talking about and what you're comparing it to. If you compare how much Lyft and Uber drivers make per hour after all expenses in New York City, they're doing slightly better than yellow taxi drivers used to do a few years ago, doing the same kind of work, and they have more flexibility. But the absolute level of, you know, earnings per hour are still not very high. We're going to have to do some things over the next few years to make sure that we push them up sort of beyond the $15 to $20 range.
Yes, the study found that over the last 5 years, monthly earnings across the gig economy have gone down. You mentioned that. It also shows that most people did not use one of these platforms for more than a quarter of the year. How does that factor into, for example, our falling unemployment rates?
Well, I think the, you know, the full-time job market, you know, is very strong. But I think what the unemployment numbers don't depict is that while the fraction of the workforce that is unemployed is very low, over the last 30 years, the earnings of people, especially in sort of the mid-range income level of the job market, have been stagnant. There's been this hollowing out of the middle class. And so an increasing number of people are going to these online platforms to try and supplement their income, or are choosing sort of a second job, part-time job, to try and sort of bring up their income. And I think the numbers in the study bear that out, because they're showing that more people are participating, but, you know, the fact that they're earning less per month on average, or that they're doing it only at a particular time of the year, is really a signature of it being part-time work to supplement your main income, or occasional work at a particular point in the year where you feel your expenses are high and you need to generate some extra cash.
All right. Well, I know you have to leave us. This seems like as good a place as any to end the conversation. Arun Sundararajan, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, John, for having me. And to your listeners, I'm easy to find online. So if you had questions that you didn't ask me and you want to shoot me an email or send me a tweet, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Arun Sundararajan is professor and in the Robert L. and Dale Atkins Rosen Faculty Fellow at New York University Stern School of Business. He wrote the book The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. In just a minute, we'll be looking at why 40% of Wisconsin students scored as proficient or higher on reading, math, and science assessment tests. But first, Republicans in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District are fighting hard to hold on to the seat House Speaker Paul Ryan has held for nearly two decades. As Laurel White reports, a former Ryan staffer is facing off in the race against a Democrat who's hoping to harness party enthusiasm to flip the seat.
Last year, millions of dollars started flowing into Wisconsin from all over the country with one purpose: defeat Paul Ryan in 2018. The money mostly went to Democrat Randy Bryce, an ironworker and union activist who had run and lost previous elections for state and local offices. But Bryce clearly struck a chord this time with his campaign announcement video released in June 2017.
I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
Bryce's ad went viral. He got millions of dollars in out-of-state campaign contributions and the endorsement of Senator Bernie Sanders, who won Wisconsin's Democratic presidential primary in 2016. But almost a year later, the narrative changed when Paul Ryan dropped out of the race.
What I realize is, if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen.
Republicans chose Brian Stile, an attorney and member of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, as their party's nominee for the seat. In an early campaign ad, Stile introduced himself as a conservative outsider who could bring Wisconsin-style politics to Washington.
Because I was raised right here in Janesville on Southeast Wisconsin-style values, I don't care much for Washington-style politics.
It's Stile's first campaign for office, but he's hardly a newcomer to GOP politics. He was once a staffer for Ryan and was a delegate at the Republican National Convention in 2016. Stile and his allies have tried to frame the race around Bryce's background. Republican groups have run ads pointing out that Bryce has been arrested 9 times for crimes including drunk driving and property damage. Joe Zepecki is a Democratic strategist who's worked on a number of campaigns in Wisconsin. He says Bryce has responded well to those attacks.
He's put it out there and said, this is who I am. Take it or leave it. You know what? We've got enough people with Ivy League credentials and who have never gotten in trouble in their whole life in Congress, and look where it's gotten us.
Not everyone agrees. Randy Bryce's own brother, James Bryce, supports Stile and even cut a TV ad on his behalf. Mark Grawl is a Republican strategist who's worked on statewide campaigns. He acknowledges Republicans are facing headwinds in the 2018 election, but says Stile has run a strong race in a GOP district.
I mean, I think he fits the district well. His background in manufacturing, I think, is a real positive right now. I think his work in the community with his family is something that is also a real positive, and I think a big contrast with Randy Bryce.
Bryce is trying to draw his own contrasts, comparing Stile's work as a corporate attorney to his own blue-collar background.
It's not about who's the more perfect person to represent you. It's about who understands the hardships that you're going to face in order to make your world a better place.
When it comes to issues, the two follow partisan divides seen elsewhere this election cycle. Bryce supports Medicare for All and the Affordable Care Act's protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Stile says more price transparency and increased use of health savings accounts would make the healthcare system better. The race doesn't have the national profile it once did, but millions of dollars are still being spent here. As Stile fights to hold on to a GOP district, and Bryce tries to harness Democratic enthusiasm to flip it. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up on the morning show, in the 2017-2018 school year, roughly 40% of Wisconsin students scored as proficient or higher on reading, math, and science assessment tests, and that number hasn't changed much in the past few years. In just a few moments, we'll take a look at what those numbers mean and what this looks like from the point of view of a teacher. But first, do your out-of-town friends chuckle when you talk because you're just so Wisconsin? Uh-huh. I can hear it now. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to learn about that Wisconsin accent, and we want to hear from you. Here's what we'd like you to do. Call our voicemail and just say this sentence. The latest ag report shows strong production, but with the hot weather now, Dawn knows there's bad news coming today. I'm not going to repeat that. The number to call is 833-42-IDEAS, 833-42-IDEAS. Now, if you've already forgotten the sentence, which I have, that's okay. You'll hear a reminder when you call. So, we want to hear you speak Scani. Just dial 833-424-3327, 833-424-3327, or 833-42-IDEAS, and let us hear you speak some Scani. I think this is going to be fun. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.